Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum, and Twitter is @InforumSF. I'm John Battelle of Federated Media and your moderator for the evening. Tonight, we're here for Inside Google, the Myths, Culture, and Secret Sauce with Stephen Levy, to my left. Stephen has made his mark on tech over the last 30 years. We just in the green room realized we've worked together for about 21 of those 30 years in one way or another. As a journalist and an editor at publications like Newsweek, Wired, PC Magazine, contributor to The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, and more, Stephen's written 6 popular books, and we're here tonight to talk with him about the story behind Google and his most recent book, In the Plex. Now, I've read In the Plex. I read it with some interest because I felt like it was he got all the good stuff that I couldn't get when I wrote 6 years ago a book about Google. And the access you got was really extraordinary. And it was sort of a pivot in terms of the way the company, which as you describe in the book, is extremely secretive, or was, until you showed up. And you spent how long?
It was about 2.5 years working on the thing.
Did you have a badge?
No. Elliot Schrag, who was the head of communications, told me he would give me a badge if I gave Google approval. So I didn't have a badge.
Well played, Stephen. But you did spend hundreds of hours in the Plex.
Right.
And I guess maybe my first question to you is, you'd been covering Google already for 7 or 8 years, for its history. And then you started this project. Did you come away from those hundreds of hours of interviews with the Googlers feeling different about the company? And if so, how?
You know, my essential perception about the company, the overall perception, wasn't radically different, but my understanding of how it worked and how it operated and what it meant really got much, much deeper. And to eliminate that, let me tell you why I actually pursued this angle of the story when I decided to do a book. Of course, as you mentioned, I had been an early observer of Google. And I remember very clearly the first time I went there. I saw the search engine in 1998 and mentioned it in Newsweek, I think in February of 99. And as that year went on, it became clear this was not only a really great product for the Internet, but the company was going to be really interesting and really important. So I asked to visit the company and meet the people behind it on my trip out to California in October of 1999. I remember it was October because I went to see the company. A lot of people were in costume. It was almost Halloween. And Larry Page, one co-founder, was dressed like a Viking. He had a big furry vest and a hat with two big horns coming out of it. And Sergey Brin, the other co-founder, was a cow. He had,
A cow.
He was a cow. And he was wearing this plastic breastplate with these huge, disgusting udders coming out of it. And the cow and the Viking took me into a room and described PageRank to me. So Google became a big focus of my work at Newsweek for the next 8 years. And then in 2007, I was invited to take a trip with a lot of Google's future young leaders. They have this program called Associate Product Managers, APMs they call them. And these are people who either come straight out of school or they've been in the workforce for a very short period of time. They're computer science majors, but they have more of an entrepreneurial bent. And they're really seen as people who could rise up and become, the top of the company eventually. And halfway through this two-year program, during which they have real big responsibilities, the very first one was asked to launch this new product called Gmail. And so halfway through the program, they go on an international trip. And Marissa Meyer, who's an executive of Google, who thought of this program, takes them to visit international offices, and they learn marketplaces around the world. And they asked me to come along. And for 16 days, going to Tokyo, Beijing, Bangalore, and Tel Aviv, we went around the world, I was in the company of these Googlers 24-7 with
Well, what were
Marxists.
Their average age?
I'd say their average age was maybe 23, 24, probably 23. There were a couple of younger ones there. I guess they were a little worried whether I'd keep up with them, but, in the karaoke bars of Tokyo, I proved that the very first night. So, and I saw a dimension of the company that I hadn't seen in my reporting, and I really hadn't seen reported before, that this was something different. It was a unique company through and through. It really pulsed to the rhythms of the internet and had these values of the internet and of the founders, and I thought it would be really interesting to write an entire book with that kind of access and that kind of familiarity with Google in its various products, with people in the search and people in ads and the other things they're working on. So I made this pitch to do that, and miraculously they said, okay, you can do it. It went way up to even to LSE, which means Larry, Sergey, and Eric, and that's one of the many acronyms that are used at Google.
Now it's just L.
That's right, actually.
Or L and S, but
maybe
Eric.
Maybe L,
is,
actually. Really.
Yeah, maybe just L. I want to get to Larry as CEO because that is in the news very recently. He had his first earnings call just recently. But before that, I wanted to ask you, because you had this access and you watched these young folks go through this process and then go back to Google. One of the, maybe it's an observation, maybe some might take it as a criticism of the company, is that it has a culture of super smart people whose main experience in the world is working at Google.
Mm-hmm.
So did you notice that culture had any either limitations or perhaps that allowed Google to do things that other companies can't do?
A little of both. I think that in the second observation, that hothouse of brainiacs and unbounded ambition to use technology to do things that were never done before helps people take on these big projects and not be weighted with the no's that they might have received at other places. But there's a certain, myopia that occurs when people aren't outside, and there's a somewhat of a groupthink, and in part that's because of their hiring process, which selects people from a certain slice of society, and there's a certain homogeneity to it.
Can you describe that hiring process? You actually got to see the process all the way through and talk to the people responsible for it and get to know how it works.
Right. Well, it's very much like the admissions process at an elite university like Harvard or Stanford, which in a sense isn't surprising because both founders were graduate students at Stanford. And one unusual thing is that they ask every applicant, no matter how old he or she may be, for their SAT scores and college GPAs. And I talked to any number of people, 38, 42 years old, whose reaction was, you must be kidding. I don't know what my college grades were, remember my SAT scores. And they say, well, you could get them from your college and you can get them from the college board and we'd like to see them. They explain it's because the SAT scores are a reflection of your intelligence quotient, your intelligence, and the GPAs are a reflection of how hard you work. Now, of course, some people in college weren't working hard, and even though later on in life they got to be working hard. In that case, you have to explain that to them. And the other things they look for are there's a certain googliness that they look for, the googliness scale. And that really is the kind of person who is ambitious, who is willing to work in a way where they could use data as a way to make their decisions or be convinced in an argument or to frame an argument, things get pretty tough in there in disagreements. And the way to win disagreements at Google is to have the data to back you up. And sometimes there's a wild card in there. If you don't have the right numbers or something like that, and you've done something extraordinary, and I think elite schools actually do the same thing, that might get you through. And I found out one case where there was someone they wanted to hire, didn't quite have the numbers, and maybe the person was snoozing in college or something, but he was the foosball champion of Italy. And Sergei thought that was great. And they hired him. And
that worked out.
I guess so, yeah.
Oh, well, I guess there's data there.
And the other thing I learned that was interesting is every single applicant, before getting hired, gets vetted by Larry Page.
Is that still true today?
I think it is. I think it was true when I interviewed him on this. We had a long interview about a year ago, and it was true then. And I sense it still might be true. No one's come up to me and saying, by the way, that process doesn't apply anymore. And he explained to me how the very deep employment package gets compressed in a way where he can sort of scan it, and then there's a software program, of course, that he can kind of like dig down if he's something he doesn't like. And every so often, he will say to a candidate that had been vetted and be ready to hire, he said, well, what is this about this number or this little snippet of experience? And the hiring counsel will have to defend that person to get the person into Google.
You mentioned that there are almost two classes of people at Google, the engineers and everybody else.
Right.
Unpack that a little bit. Google's clearly a very engineering-driven company. And you say that if you're going to work at Google and you're not an engineer, you got to be okay with the fact
right.
that you just don't have the same throw weight.
Right, right. And, you know, any number of people who weren't engineers told me that's their lot in life in Google. That, you know, that they have, the engineers are at the center of things. In the product groups, it's really the tech leads who are the people who really push the products, and they're the ones who may not necessarily dictate all the design aspects, but they could, you know, they have to be convinced to, usually by data, you know, to go along in a certain path. And the people who aren't engineers, are in any number of ways, made known that, the engineers ruled. I remember talking once to one of the, it was a pretty high executive in sales, Jeff Levick, who worked with the top guy, Tim Armstrong, who later went to AOL. I think Jeff went with him.
Yeah, I went with him, yeah.
Yeah, and he told me of a story. It was early in Google's history where some of the salespeople had a meeting, and it wasn't at a fancy hotel. It was some mid-price hotel in Mountain View, and Sergey Brin went to the meeting. And instead of listening to the concerns and the things before the salespeople, Sergey spent the hour tinkering with a control box for the AV system. And Jeff said, at that moment I realized, and forgive the language, it's his language, that they don't really give a rat's ass about us. They're interested in the engineering stuff.
Now, I remember the first 4 or 5 years after Google got sort of very well known, maybe you could call it 2000 to 2005, in the Valley, there was really no hotter place to land a job than Google for a lot of reasons, many of which you've discussed. One of them was that it was pre-IPO, and that was like a golden ticket. It turned out to be quite a golden ticket. But you've been covering and deep in the company for the last 2.5 years, when if you're a super talented engineer or a super talented non-engineer willing to put up with what you just described, you have some options right now. You can go to Zynga, you can go to Facebook, you can go to Twitter. There are a lot of companies that are pre-IPO and have that same heat. Mm-hmm. Did you notice that Google was aware of this, and did the company change anything to try to address that?
Well, I think in some ways they did. Salaries have gone up, and Google salaries traditionally have not been the highest in the valley. And of course, before the IPO, there was that carrot lurking ahead of them to grab. I think that they tried to be more aggressive. It gets pretty tough. And they give the argument, I guess, that Microsoft used to give, saying that if you work for Google, the products you work on will be used by hundreds of millions of people. And that's something. I think a more compelling argument is made to really great computer scientists to say, we're the only company still that's really going to be working in this massive, massive scale. And there's amazing computer science problems that we work on every day that push the field. I don't think Zynga necessarily has that argument to make there and saying, well, you're going to, you know, be making, items, you know, different color cows for Farmville. It doesn't seem as compelling to be in the center of the world there. And if you're working in artificial intelligence, I still think there's no other company that has Google's ambitions in AI. And that distinguishes it really from those companies you mentioned there. So it's really the place to be. It's almost a combination of a research lab and a product company.
Right. Many companies in the Valley have had that sort of lightning in a bottle for some period of time. You're a historian of the Valley, and you know, at one time or another, DEC had an extraordinary lab.
DEC's demise actually turned out to be Google's bonus, because you know, just as DEC, a Western Research Lab, was fading, and its scientists were very unhappy that they had had not one but two purchases there, or two levels of not invented here going on there, that there was Google willing to hire their best people.
Right.
And they went there.
They indeed did, yes.
But to your question, I think where you were going was, is Google now in that has lost the lightning?
Well, I don't want to presume. You've spent a lot of time there, and one of the things I took away from the book was a reminder of how astonishing the infrastructure that this company has truly is.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very, very guarded secret how many processors and CPUs and servers the company has. And you didn't exactly list a number, because I'm sure that number is going up every day. But you did give a sense of the scale of it. And as I understand it, it's quite possibly the largest single instance of a computing platform on Earth.
Yeah,
larger than any government has, any other corporation has.
It could be. Yeah, the government's a little secretive about that too. But let's say we do know that it's the biggest owner of fiber in the world. It's the biggest computer maker in the world, because they make their own servers there. So there's a lot of biggests there in terms of their data center. We don't know. It's still a secret how many they have. After a million, they stopped acknowledging, and so it's in the millions. And there's this paper written by a couple of their scientists that talk about we talk about cluster computing and parallel computing. They talk about what's called the warehouse computer, that every data center really operates just like a single computer, or they break them up into these clusters of a few hundred thousand computers. And we went back and forth when I was fact-checking the book on what a cluster means, right? And it's essentially something that they're able to handle a search query by itself, multiple copies of the internet on it, and
so multiple copies of the entire internet, in the memory of the
right, and it's all in memory. And it's interesting, because another thing I found out that was interesting is every single engineer in search has the whole internet at his or her personal access.
So think about that. That as a like it's just here's
a hush
the whole
comes
internet
across the room. Yeah,
yeah. for the radio audience, a hush.
Yes.
Now, did that ever frighten you?
The scale didn't. I think what is a little intimidating is the insouciance with which they treat all this infrastructure and the collected information it has. It's a fact of life to the engineers. It's a challenge for the communications people to assure the public that they're not out after us. And maybe it should be a higher priority to the executives to assure the rest of us.
Right, right. I wanted to ask one other question about people and hiring and then move on, but I didn't get to it before. And this has always puzzled me. I wondered if you ever asked some of the long-timers there, the folks who joined before the IPO and are still there and are just absolutely wealthy, mm-hmm. just so crazy wealthy that they could do almost anything they wanted to, but for some reason they keep showing up.
Right.
Why?
I do ask them that, or they volunteer it, really. They say it's still interesting. They're still taking on big problems. They're still finding new things and new problems. And, you know, I know we're going to talk about Larry as CEO at some point, but one fascinating thing that's happened recently is Larry did a reorganization of the company, and several people were elevated or acknowledged who were already serving in high roles as senior vice president in charge of this or that. And a few of them had been there since really, really early on. A couple of them were among the first 10 employees. And you think about it, people that wealthy, they were also asked to recommit for several more years to go on this new ride with Larry as CEO. He said, I don't want anyone who's leading any of my teams to leave before this work of re-energizing Google is done. So these people re-enlisted. And it would have been a pretty good time, a pretty good point for any of them to say, well, you know what, it's been a wonderful ride, but I'm just going to go off and buy an island in Hawaii or something like that, or start a major company or do whatever comes post-Google. Instead, they re-enlisted, which I actually think is quite a statement of their belief in Larry.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Larry. You've got to know Larry as an outsider, as a journalist, probably better than anybody. You spent more time with him. He is somewhat famously recalcitrant when it comes to dealing with the press. Now, he, you know, will have to deal with the press more as the CEO.
We'll see.
Well, I suppose we will see. But you spent a lot of time with him. So what's he like?
He's, as you say, he's not an extrovert. He is, you know, very focused. There's a story someone told me once that I think is very revealing about Larry. So Larry and Sergey, at one point in Google's history, decided to dismiss their assistants. They had a group of people that were called LSA. Everything's an acronym at Google. So LSA stood for Larry Sergey Assistants. And it was four very smart young women who did all the support work that the two founders needed. And one of the things they did is if a Googler would have a request to meet one of them, one of the LSAs would take the request and give it to Larry or Sergey. And in large part because of that reason, they got rid of the assistants. Larry told me that he didn't want anyone with the ability to take a request like that to him because meetings were his least favorite thing. So what happened as a result was that people at Google had to find alternative means of locating Larry and Sergey. And I compared it to the kind of people that stay around airports and watch planes. They write down the little numbers of the planes as they fly in and out of the airports, and they share that information with each other. There was a Larry and Sergey watching society that would keep track of them, so you might know the best place to intercept them if you needed them. So one engineer was working on a project in Zurich, and he had heard that another project was going on at Google. It was very similar to his. And he really needed an answer. He felt he needed an answer from Larry or Sergey to understand whether his team really should keep working on the project. So he flew from Zurich to Mountain View, and he had been told that the best place to get them would be after a TGIF, the weekly all-hands meeting that they hold. And Larry and Sergey, quite often, if they're both in town, will run it together. And in those occasions, the normally shy Larry actually comes out of his shell, and it's almost like Hope and Crosby. The two of them banter, and it's very witty, and they're totally in a comfort zone with their own employees.
Right.
So he goes to Sergey, and Sergey listens to him and says, we really should find Larry. And Larry is in his office right now. So the guy goes to Larry's office in Building 43. Larry's sitting there. The room's darkened. He's sitting in front of a computer there. And he introduces himself, and he tells a story. And Larry quickly says something noncommittal, which leads him to think his product might not be going that far. But then very quickly, the talk turns to nuclear fusion. And Larry,
obviously,
Larry talks about the difficulties having finding the information he wants about nuclear fusion. And this guy's head is spinning around, and he's having, winds up having a great conversation. And he realizes afterwards, he told me, he said, you know, Larry's not the kind of guy you go to for help now immediately. He's the guy who, he's not thinking, how can I help this guy? He's thinking, what can we do to make the world better in 10 years? And that's his instinct, and that has got there. And the thing I found, I had one massive long interview with Larry. I think it might be the longest interview he's ever given there.
How long was it?
It was 2 hours. And then he came back and he had some more things to say. And the things he had to say were things he actually had said before, but he wanted to just make it understood to me how important ambition was to him. He feels that we're at a time where technology has made lofty goals that were formerly impossible now within our grasp. And he can't understand why more people don't have these lofty goals now that they could be achieved. He said, why aren't people more ambitious? And specifically, he wants people at Google to be more ambitious, but in general, he asked that question. And during our conversation, he talked about, well, since the time he was very young, he had these ambitions. And I think you know about when he was at the University of Michigan, he designed a transportation system that he was astonished when he went back there a few years ago. They hadn't really implemented with monorails around the Ann Arbor campus and things like that.
But there's a bit of Walt Disney in him, isn't there?
Well, I think so. I think so.
Yeah.
And that's really a key. You understand a lot of Google when you see that through that filter there. And that's a hiring criteria for sure. They want
ambition.
People like that. Absolutely. Yeah. They want people like that. And it explains a little why a brain drain is a problem now. If the company is big and a lot of people have to keep certain projects running, a certain amount of bureaucracy runs in, people like that are going to get restless and they're going to leave. So Google, in a way, self-selects for people who can't stand bureaucracy. And bureaucracy is inevitable in a big company, so they have to get their way around that problem.
Yeah. You told the story, which was mostly rumored up until you reported it, and much of the book has, you know, if you were a Google watcher over the past 10 years, there was always stories in blogs or stories in newspapers or magazines that had a source or two sources saying this seemed to have happened. Mm-hmm. And one of them was, how did it turn out that Eric Schmidt joined Apple's board? And you actually really reported the relationship that developed and how it developed between Steve Jobs mm-hmm. and the founders mm-hmm. and how Eric joined the board. Tell us when the VCs behind Google forced Larry and Sergey to actually hire a CEO.
Yeah,
that they were okay with hiring was who?
Steve Jobs. the agreement was there when they got the money from the two biggest, most prestigious venture capital firms in Silicon Valley, which was very unusual that Sequoia Capital and Kleiner Perkins would be co-lead investors in a company like that. But that was the ambition. Larry and Sergey said, you know, even though no one's ever done it, they'll do it for us. And this was in the peak, the last
98.
Yeah, 98, just when the boom was, you know, still going, darkness was around the corner, but things were humming right then, and they were able to get those two companies to work together. Man, putting together a press release was a monster, I can tell you that. they said that you're going to have a CEO, and the term that may not have used to Larry and Sergey, but is the term of art used is adult supervision. And so a few months after they got the money, they called John Doerr, the investor for Kleiner Perkins, and said they were reneging, that they feel that they could run it themselves. And John, his first instinct, he said in his mind was, I'm out of here. But he held back. He said, I'm going to set up all these meetings with you. And you're going to talk to all these CEOs of these great companies, Jeff Bezos and, and Steve Jobs. And that was when they came back and said, we found our CEO, Steve Jobs. And then he managed to deflect them from that because I don't think Steve Jobs was going to be the head of Google. And they picked Eric Schmidt. But that relationship between Larry and Sergey and Steve Jobs had been started there. And it flowered over the next few years. And Steve would go on walks with Sergey in Palo Alto and think he saw himself as sort of a mentor to those two young men. And what was exciting to Steve was that Google was this rising company that really had a grasp on the internet, yet it didn't have products that competed with Apple's. It was an entirely complementary relationship. And he felt the two of them really would be an amazing, powerful counter to Microsoft, which still has the operating systems, but it doesn't seem so fearsome anymore. In the early 2000s, it was still something that cast a big shadow on Silicon Valley.
Well, it just crushed Netscape and taken over the browser world and seemed to be on its way to doing to the internet what it had already done to operating systems.
Right. And Google's new CEO, Eric Schmidt, was still very, very wary of Microsoft. And he instituted a policy of utter secrecy about how much money Google was making. It was called the hiding strategy because he was afraid Microsoft would see how much money Google was making and push all his resources into search before Google was well established enough to fend them off. So this relationship went on very, very well. As you say, Eric was on the board, but Eric wasn't the only person who had a relationship with both companies. If you look at it, there were several people on both boards who were advisors of both companies. Al Gore, who was on Apple's board, was an advisor to Google. The head of Genentech, both boards. And it was almost like Bill Campbell, who was the chief advisor and coach of the Google executive suite, was on the Apple board, and Steve Jobs his best friend. So it was almost like it was one company with this intertwined leadership.
Did you ever uncover any potential combination of those two companies early on?
Things were discussed all the time, of things they might venture off into together. But then came, the first sign of trouble, I think, for Steve was not the phone, but was when Google did its browser there. And Google had been concerned about Microsoft. Eric Schmidt had tried to dissuade Larry and Sergey from doing a browser. They wanted to do it right away, to build their own browser. But Eric, again, he was afraid of what he called mooning the giant. He didn't want to bring Microsoft to alert there.
Bait the bear.
Yeah, interesting. Meanwhile, I remember conversations I had with Bill Gates around there, and he mainly was ticked off at Google because they were getting all this press attention and things like that. So you would mention Google to them, and he'd say, "Ooh, they're cool. They wear black. They're young," and he would make fun of them like that.
Yeah, he said the same thing to me.
Yeah, and there's a couple of really fun stories about Bill in the book there, his reaction to Google at various places. But then, so the browser, which was built on really the Apple's core of
on WebKit.
Yeah, the browser on WebKit. And at a certain point, some of his engineers were getting these offers from Google. And Steve thought, what is going on here? But he calmed down, and then came the Android phone. And what I found that was new that I hadn't heard before in talking to people on the Android team was that actually one reason why Steve might have felt blindsided by it, because it was public that Google had bought this company called Android, and he knew who Andy Rubin, the head of the Android company, was because he had worked at Apple as a well-known figure in the Valley, was that Google was actually working on two versions of the Android phone. And one was called Sooner, and that was obviously the one that would come first. And the other was called the Dream. And that was this full-featured phone that would come later. So I think what happened was that Steve was led to believe or came to believe that what he thought was Sooner, which was a phone which was in no way competitive with the iPhone, was the phone that Google was working on. But in 2007, when the iPhone came out, Google immediately abandoned Sooner and fast-forwarded straight to the Dream. And when Steve saw the phone, I did have this, utterly sourced that Steve came to Mountain View at one point to view the Android phone, and he was not happy with what he saw. And that really was the nature of the split, and that's why it came to the point where Steve Jobs, this happened a couple days after he introduced the iPad, which interestingly I learned that Eric Schmidt, never saw the iPad, even though he was on the Apple board. He had to leave the board meetings when things right. were competitive to Google were discussed. That Steve came before the employees of Apple and went on this tirade about Google. You know, he said that we don't do a search engine. Why are they doing a phone? And and then he took on the unofficial corporate model, "Don't be evil," and described it with a barnyard epithet.
He swore, is what you're saying.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And one thinks of the Sergei and the cow uniform, if you want a picture.
Part of the epithet was bull in the...
Yes, yes.
Right. So the Google-Apple war is ongoing, and it is fully joined now. I mean, it is a serious clash.
I understand there's still attempts to repair it. Those things aren't dead yet, but it really is in disarray from what it was.
And Google is taking the point of view, if I could paraphrase just, its public pronouncements, that Android is an open system, that anyone can modify, create apps for, add value on top of, whereas Apple is a closed system, mm-hmm. highly manicured,
right.
very elegant, but essentially controlled by one person or one company.
Mm-hmm.
This open versus closed theme seems very strong at Google along a lot of different axes. Why? What is it that drives that at Google?
Well, I think that it's a geek company. They love the base of open source. They love the idea behind it. They would like to be in touch with the wider community. Though there's open source software, and then there's the interest of Google. So whereas they're happy to let people use an open source version of some of their great internal software called MapReduce there, there's other things that aren't as free to the rest of the world. Now, on Android, I think there's this argument going on, and it's on a high plane that we're open and the iPhone is closed. But really, the difference to their customers and the customers of these phones are the handset manufacturers and the carriers that offer them is that to those, Android is free to the handset carriers the mobile carriers and the handset manufacturers. Whereas Apple is a system where this costs them money. It's this big financial arrangement there. And, so open source fits that model that Google has used to seed the ecosystem with their phones. It's a different business model entirely, because Google hopes to make a lot of money off the Android phones because they're Trojan horses for Google products.
Right.
And the day quickly approaches when more searches will be done on mobile devices than they will be on our computers, our laptops and desktop computers. And if Google isn't in position to have something where people will use Google searches on those phones, it's in big trouble.
Right.
So I think the success of Android has been maybe an underappreciated way that Google's actually dodged a big bullet that could have hurt it greatly.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Larry's new tenure as CEO, he wants to re-energize the company.
Right.
For many years, the informal motto at Google was "Don't be evil."
Mm-hmm.
I think it still is part of its
right.
brand.
They have not disavowed that.
They have not disavowed it. Is Larry is he re-upping his commitment to that motto? And do you think that there are? Does it cut both ways? This concept of being a company that does no evil, because isn't evil a relatively subjective concept?
Actually, I think that the concept was adopted at Google because they thought it was a binary concept. And when that expression first arose at Google, it was in a meeting where they were discussing corporate values. It was run by an HR person. People were writing sort of platitudinous things on a little easel. And then one engineer, it was Paul Buckhite, the creator of Gmail, said, this is all junk. Why don't we just say, don't be evil, and leave it at that? And different people at Google thought, some people thought it had a direct correlation to Microsoft, being don't be like Microsoft. But other people thought that it would be the kind of thing that you were in a meeting and something would come up and you'd say, oh, that sounds evil. And everyone would say, sounds evil. Oh, no, we can't do this.
So evil is like not googly.
Well, not googly, but it's evil. It's, you know it when you see it. You know, it's the wrong thing to do. And things get fuzzier, though, when you're a big company and you're taking on these complex things.
Like China, for example.
Like China, exactly.
You did a lot of deep reporting on China. And before I ask you about that, we have, in about 5 minutes, we'll go to questions. So if you want to start, there are mics there. There's one mic. There is a mic right there. And we need you to use the mic so that the broadcast can pick it up. But the China question, many have speculated, and you report, that it was a source of significant conflict in the LSE, the Larry Sergey Eric Troika, or triumvirate of management, in that they disagreed about what to do in China. They went in for 5 years, and then they left.
Right, right. Well, the story there, and it's almost operatic, and the themes and the complexities, is that in order to go into China, of course, you had to make a horrible compromise, and which is you had to censor the results of the search engine. And just picture this for Google. This is a company that spent every fiber of its being trying to deliver the best and most accurate and fullest results when people type things into the search engine. And they were asked now to say, the most relevant results we won't give you because an oppressive government wants to deny them to its citizens. That's terrible.
Sounds evil.
Yeah, and especially terrible for Sergey Brin, who came over to the United States as a young child because his family was fleeing oppression in Russia. So this was not an abstract concept to him. But Google managed to rationalize this decision to itself, mainly, by constructing what I call a moral spreadsheet. They said, well, you know, in this part of the spreadsheet, we're doing censorship, and that's really bad. It's a big red cell. But we're going to be doing some other things that are positive. We're going to be spreading more information among the people in China, and that will lead them to ask for more. And we're going to tell them, in the cases that we do censor, because we have to censor, that there's results they may not be seeing. And then they'll see that, and they'll wonder, why is our government not letting us see these things? And they'll rise up. And eventually, Google felt that it was going to change China. Instead, I think China changed Google. And over the next few years, a series of events, which some of them fairly horrible and some fairly amusing, really. Some of them were due to cultural gaffes or missteps, and other ones because the Chinese government has a degree of evil to it, led a lot of people at Google to want to reconsider that, even before the break-in by people who were almost certainly part of the Chinese government or supported by the Chinese government.
And Google was hacked. And
right, yeah, yeah.
That was almost the straw that broke the camel's back.
And that's what was said to me by many people at Google, that the straw that broke the camel's back, and implying, really, that the whole experiment was under question, certainly by a lot of executives before that happened.
Right. Before we get to the first question, I want to ask you what you believe Google's weaknesses are. And I'll throw one potential out there, which is it has so much data and seems to be obsessed and driven by data and has a lot of very young people in charge of that data. Do you think we can trust Google?
Well, and they say this a lot. Without that trust, it goes away. We have to trust them. Google can't say, you know what, we keep information, it's not by who you are, it's not by your name, but they keep track of user behavior on their search engine. And one thing I learned is how important, why they fight so hard, why they say they have to keep it 9 months, when even their competitors now get rid of it sooner. And that's because that information is the means by which they use to improve the search engine there. They analyze that information, and they use it to feed almost this, like, this growing intelligence, like in a science fiction novel, to learn about the world, right? And without that information, they can't improve the search engine. They can't improve Google in general. So in order for us to keep using it, we have to trust Google. In order for us to keep putting our mail, our private information, in documents and Gmail, we have to trust Google. So there's any number of ways we have to trust it. And they say, time and again, this is why you can't trust us, because we can't exist unless you trust us. Now, I'm a little wary of that. I remember when Tylenol poisoned people, and who could trust Tylenol after that? Yet Tylenol is a hugely selling medication now. So I'm not totally convinced that, you know, one mistake is going to be a Chernobyl of privacy there, right. and the trust for Google there.
Right.
So that, you know, that is a weakness. I think maybe a bigger weakness would be that Google, when it wants to pursue something, it pursues it. And Google executives intellectually know that they are a big company with a big effect on people, but it isn't really baked into their beings. They still proceed as if they're a smaller company that is free to go and do what it wants and doesn't have to worry too much about collateral damage. And I think that's already earned Google a good degree of government scrutiny of what they do, and that will continue really throughout the rest of Google's history.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you know, I think they have to be more proactive, and specifically, I think it would help Google a lot if Larry Page were more proactive in addressing these issues and letting us know what they're up to.
Right.
Because though Google, in some respects, is transparent to its employees, it's very transparent. Everyone could look and learn about their fellow employees and their goals and through the internal website. But from outside, even though they let me in and they now do videos that explain a little how their products work, it's still fairly opaque. I compare it to a lobster. It's a hard shell, but kind of gooey on the inside there. I think it would help Google if they saw the perception of Google like a product. You know, Larry's very product-oriented, and the people he elevated, right, are each in charge of a different product group. And it would be nice if Google's perception was a product that Larry wanted to improve and worked very hard at that.
Interesting. Well, there are many, many things we didn't get to, including the social question about Google, and also I really want to know your view of the Google book settlement as an author. But we want to get to questions, so we have
one. Maybe they'll come up from some of our questioners.
Good evening. Had one question in regards to Google's design aesthetic. One thing that you can see with a lot of Google products is it's clear that it's put together by very smart girls and boys doing really creative stuff. But when the user experience comes together, and this is a strong comparison to the sort of things that Apple does, it's very clear that it was done by engineers. The UX oftentimes is a frustrating experience. And I'm curious, with the reset of Larry taking the helm, will there be maybe a renewed focus on Google to actually attack that design aesthetic piece? I mean, like Michael Jones, who was their chief technology advocate, that's what he says is his mission. But it hasn't come to the surface yet in how Google's apps work. So I was curious on that question.
Actually, just my narrative arc of the book, I really didn't have time to discuss this in detail. I actually did a lot of work on this and watched some of the UX struggles at Google there. Larry, in particular, is a person who believes in a very, he's an engineer, and he sees in a very stripped down way the way things should look there. And Google has had a lot of criticism of his design interface. Every couple of years, some designer stomps out of there saying, this is a place that doesn't understand artists. Some of the people who...
And they go to Apple.
Right, yeah, well, yeah. Some of the people who work design the interface, they've had problems too. And one person told me that she had it all explained to her what the real aesthetic behind Google is when Marissa Meyer, who's an important person there, who worked a lot on the way Google looks, explained to them that Google really should look like it's designed by a machine, because that way people won't perceive that we're biased. So if people trust the search results there, they would implicitly feel that way if there weren't, you know, an individual bent to the design.
interesting. I'm not sure that works when you get to phones and you get to YouTube and you get to a lot of these products that, you know.
Well, I think, and there are a lot of people at Google who think that, who are pushing back there. But it'll be interesting to see what happens. Sometimes people like to game Larry on this. They're, you know, he's very much against animations or swooshy things, right? And someone once told me about a product review. They had to get a thing through Larry, and what they did was they packed the room with a big team who was working on the project. And when they showed it to him, people were clapping and yelling and screaming, and they really got him into it there. And he sort of swept along by the excitement and okayed this particular design.
It's a tip for aspiring Google product managers. Another question?
Thanks for a great session, you guys. Really enjoyable. And I wanted to ask you a question, John. You gave me a great segue with mentioning YouTube. And this has to do with in a sort of a data-driven engineering culture like Google. Maybe as we move more aggressively into the video space with YouTube and acquisitions of companies like Next New Networks and creating programs to help other people create more mid-tail and long-tail content, do you think that culture is going to be helpful or hurtful in their efforts? Because they're dealing with people who also manage from the heart as well as the head in those creative entities.
Well, Google did a smart thing when it bought YouTube. And it didn't rebrand YouTube into Google Video 2. It didn't physically integrate YouTube onto the Googleplex, the big campus. It left YouTube up in San Bruno, 25 miles away, and it's sort of a little microculture of its own. It has Google aspects to it, googly aspects to it, but it has a sort of feel that's a little different, and it is a little more content oriented there, more in like a media company. So I think that there's a little more play, and there's an understanding that in design they can be a little different than the rest of the Google products there, and don't have to be integrated so tightly.
We have one more question here.
While you're talking about Google's battle with the Chinese, I was simply wondering if Google does hire Chinese Americans, and if so, what percentage do you think they would be, especially Chinese on H-1B visas?
Especially
Chinese on H-1B visas?
Well, working, doing this book, and really just observing anywhere in Silicon Valley, you understand why H-1B visas are so important. You just walk into a Google cafe at any point, and you see the diversity there. And I mentioned before the great computer scientists they hired early in their time there. And a lot of them came from outside the U.S. There were some. One funny thing is two of the top early search engineers actually studied for their test to get into India's top university together in high school. And I think that with more restrictions on immigrants coming in, Google wouldn't be what it was. That's simple to say. In terms of Chinese Americans, Google, of course, hires Chinese people who come from China and study here, and then look for work in the United States there. But it was interesting to see how many of those people who were Chinese-born, now living in America, engineers, were lured to go to China, to go back to China to help Google in doing this. And I remember talking to one woman who told me a story. It really made an impact on me. She was in her early 30s. She just had a baby. They bought a BMW, her and her husband, and they were living a very comfortable life out here. Yet she took a risk, and she went back to China. She became what they call the sea turtle, someone born in China who comes here and then comes back for this great adventure in China. And these people felt very upset. They almost felt betrayed when Google made that decision to pull out there. And there was a very emotional meeting when they were able to express their feelings back to Mountain View. And I almost thought it was like the soldiers left on the beach at the Bay of Pigs, where their bosses pulled out, and they were left there with their dream shattered in a sense. I think, to be fair, some of them are still there and have readjusted. But it was, from what I hear, it was an extremely emotional meeting where the people felt the ground was cut out from under them.
Got another question here.
Hi, Stephen. My question is about a couple of areas that Google seems that sometimes they have a great deal of interest in, and at other times either seems sort of helpless or to abandon their interests, and those are philanthropy and social. They carved off a huge chunk of Google for Google.org and made the commitment to Larry Brilliant, and that doesn't seem to become the roaring barn fire that it could be. They've had projects like 10 to the 100th, where they scooped up a lot of ideas and kept putting off the announcement date, and then it sort of petered out into, well, we're going to invest some money in science education. And the other is social, where they're giving up so much search and ad turf to other people, and they seem deeply invested in that at times. And I'm just curious whether you think that they're helpless at those things or that the interest is not really there or something
else. Right, well, the Google.org history, you're right. It ebbs and flows, and there is a scene I mentioned. I'll get to one of the interesting Bill Gates stories in here. That it was a couple years ago, a Google employee approached Bill Gates. I happened to be witness to this, and asked him what he thought of Google.org. And Bill, he sort of almost rose up, you know, out of his suit, and you know, he said, like, you know, well, I've never seen a more publicized organization with so little impact. He said, you know, you can't change people by giving like search results or data. You need money. And, you know, and of course he's giving billions and billions of dollars there. And there's been some terrific things that come out of Google.org and clearly, it started with a lot of ambitions, but it has changed direction a few times, and I guess it will again because there's another person in charge of it, I think, just last week. It's one of those things that I learned about through the press, and Google, I don't think, hasn't formally confirmed, but I think it's pretty sure it happened that a new person took charge of Google.org last week. So that was a case. That's a case, I think, where things still have to be solidified, and Google could do a lot more with its foundation, and maybe Shona will do that.
Now, the other question had to do with social, and you know, I think if you think about the most gregarious, social, outgoing, you know, relationship-driven person, it's probably not a Google engineer.
Right.
And Google has famously not done well in the social space.
It
came out with Orkut, which was a early social network that took off very rapidly and then sort of hibernated or flew south to Brazil and stayed there. And Facebook just took off. Do people talk about Google's social failures inside of Google?
They're very conscious of it. And as the years went on, in my time there, they became more and more conscious of it as Facebook kept growing and growing and growing. And the big threat to Google from Facebook is that you go on Facebook, you tell Facebook who you're in contact with, who your friends are, what you like, what you're doing. It's all incredibly valuable information that Google could use to improve its search and improve its products in a number of ways, and Google can't get at it. And it drives Google nuts, and they're terrified that there's going to be a billion people using Facebook, and this other information is going to be there that they can't get at.
Right. Their mission is to organize the world's information and make it accessible, except if it's on Facebook.com.
Yeah. And so I think that what they want to do is they're obviously in the middle of a big initiative I identified in the book as it's codenamed Emerald Sea. And what I found fascinating was that when they came up with this code name, they went on and they Googled it. And the first picture that came up was a painting by a 19th century artist named Alfred Bierstadt. And it portrayed a giant wave and you know, almost crashing on the shore. And there was a little sailboat just in the nook of the wave that looks like it's a goner, right? It's going to be done. And it was explained to me that Google sees social in a way that it could ride this great wave to glory, or it could be engulfed by it.
Right. Interesting. All right, we just have a few minutes, so quick question.
Yeah, you stole my thunder with the social thing, so I'll ask a question about the growth of Google as far as talent. So Google is growing not only in Mountain View and kind of sucking talent from there, but also you got CMU, you've got Israel, you've got China, India, where these little satellite Googles. Do you see Google's growth being constrained by its lack of availability of talent, and where is its growth going to be as far as international now that it needs to kind of suck in intellect from everywhere?
Right. Well, there is this huge competition for engineers all over the world, and you're right. One reason why Google established all these international centers is so they can draw on that talent of those various places. I talk about a meeting where Google first figured out its strategy for international. And Larry and Sergey and Eric were there, and this other engineer they brought in from HP, a really super smart guy named Kannan Pashupathy. And they said, well, okay, how many engineers do we want to have overseas? You know, and they said, well, and Larry says, how many does Microsoft have? And they said, 25,000. He said, maybe we should have 1 million.
And he wasn't kidding.
Yeah, which that's the way Larry thinks there. Well, they don't have 1 million, but it's going to be tough to get even the number they want because of this great competition in engineers. And you think about the difficulty the United States has in producing its own engineers in our educational system. And it is a big problem, not just for Google, but for everyone who wants to develop products that are going to change the world in technology.
Now, we're on a very tight schedule, so if it's a fast question, we can take it.
Anything unique or interesting about the way Google deals with legal battles and lawyers?
Yeah. The Google lawyers told me that where other companies' lawyers' jobs to say no, their job is to help make what the engineers want to do go forward. So that, my experience with lawyers, that's a big change.
That's a big change from the lawyer's point of view also. So there is a newly founded Inform tradition that we ask all the speakers the following question. So you'll have to answer this question now. Stephen, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Well, I'll just take an immediate short-term concern, which would be, and something that Google actually wants to do, is really cheap, super high-speed broadband for everyone. I think it would be transformative. Right now, we're developing a lot of products that just can't be used by most people. I think if we had it around the world, we would hasten a lot of the benefits that we can get from technology. I'm not saying it would bring about world peace, which some people think would happen there, but certainly it would give an economic lift to everyone. So, and it would help me in my place in Western Massachusetts, where I don't have any broadband at all.
Well, please join me in thanking Stephen Levy for coming tonight. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inform, Connect Your Intellect is adjourned.
Whoa. Thank you.